You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Stephen.
Hey.
How you doing?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. I'm very excited about this conversation. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is a Non-Zero Podcast. You're Stephen Adler, publisher of the aptly named Stephen Adler's Substack newsletter at stephenadler.substack.com. You are also somebody who, until a few months ago, worked at OpenAI. You'd been there since 2020. You decided to leave, and after you left, you expressed some concerns about the pace of AI development. You were quoted as saying an AGI race, you know, meaning the race toward artificial general intelligence, is a very risky gamble with a huge downside. So I want to talk about that. Now, you also are among a number of former OpenAI employees who were part of an amicus brief, if that's the right term, kind of contesting the aspiration of OpenAI to shed its nonprofit status. Now, since you filed the brief, there's been a development. They say they are shedding it, but it's kind of, I don't know, I kind of have my reasons for skepticism, but we'll talk about that and how happy you may or may not be with what they're doing. And, you know, I also want to just get into the whole the logic behind your concerns and kind of the range of concerns, because there's a whole bunch of different kinds of safety concerns. But before I do any of that, I would like to ask you to recall a certain part of your experience about OpenAI, because you were there at a very special time, right? I think it was in 2022 that I think initially the image generation started getting people's attention, the DALL-E thing. And then either at the end of 2022 or the beginning of 2023, ChatGPT 3.5 came out and got a lot of attention. And then within a few months, 4.0 came out and just kind of blew people away, I would say. And the rest is history. And you had been there since 2020. Now, first of all, what was your connection to those projects? What role did you have a connection to 3.5 and 4.0?
Yeah, I'm trying to think what the most efficient way of describing it is. I think the answer is I worked on all of those different degrees of responsibility. DALL-E 2, so the launch, I remember, was April 2022.
That was the image generator, yeah.
That's the image generator, that's right. And my experience of it at the time was it was maybe the first time that people in my life knew the company that I worked at. From my perspective, mm-hmm. the initial GPT-3 was really mind-blowing. There had been stuff prior to that as well. But DALL-E 2 was when OpenAI was really making the New York Times and catching people's imagination about what can be done with AI.
Mm-hmm. And GPT 3.0 hadn't gotten much kind of real publicity. Some journalists were starting to write about the LLMs at that point, but it was 3.5 that really got people's attention. And were you connected to the release of 3.5 and or 4.0?
Yeah. GPT-3 was buzzy, I would say, but in more limited technology circles.
In your circles, not mine, yeah.
GPT-2, you know, even before then. I remember so I didn't work at OpenAI at this point. This, I believe, was early 2019. And I remember seeing 2.0, yes, that's right. I remember seeing generated newspaper articles that GPT-2 had written that seemed to have a coherence and a continuous narrative in them that AI systems hadn't really been capable of before mm-hmm. that point.
And so then what was your connection to 3.5 and 4.0 within the company? What were you doing that was relevant to the development and or release?
The way that I normally describe my role is that there were three or four different chapters So at the beginning, I led product safety for a range of products at OpenAI. This included GPT-3 up through DALL-E 2 or so. There was the GPT-4 chapter when I led the deployment process from essentially like a bit before the model was finished training through. We got the go-ahead for certain forms of production testing, not all the way through the full production launch, which came in spring 2023, but more fall 2022 timeline. And that's when I transitioned to working on longer-term AI governance and AGI readiness questions at the company.
So to be in charge of deployment for 4.0, was that not a safety-related, AI safety-related job, as many of your jobs were? Was that, what did that involve on a day-to-day basis?
I think putting it as being in charge is definitely too strong. You know, I was supporting Mira Murati and other folks at OpenAI on these decisions that ultimately were going to be gated by a body called the Deployment Safety Board, which was a joint board between OpenAI and Microsoft that authorized any go-ahead decisions. And so my role, it certainly had a large part of safety, but this was more managing across different work streams and figuring out what needed to happen from different parts of the company to get us to a point where we felt comfortable making such a deployment decision. And so before this, I worked more on the direct safety questions. What would our policies be? How would we figure out if people were violating these? You know, what was the right way to manage follow-up from there? Whereas this project was more about bringing together all sorts of different parts of the company, which certainly included those safety issues, but also included things like if demand was going to be as high for these models as we expected, you know, what sorts of engineering and load management did we need to do to be prepared to actually serve it in production?
Okay. So what was it like? I mean, were you aware, and if so, how early were you aware that you were witnessing something momentous? You know, because I think generations hence, assuming they're around, and we'll get to that question later, we'll look back and, you know, and see this is one of the most significant moments in the history of technological development, personally. I mean, this phase in kind of deep learning, as they call this particular revolution in AI, and as it happened, your company was the at the epicenter. Was there? Do you think you fully appreciated that? And like, what was it like?
Yeah, it was a pretty wild opportunity and quite a lot of pressure and complexity to get it to go right. Definitely when we had these versions of GPT-4 that had a bit of post-training, and so they weren't just the raw base model anymore, but they were a bit more directable, it really felt like the first time that one of these large language models was genuinely useful in day-to-day work. There were all sorts of things that we were seeing that they were able to do that we didn't necessarily know how they were able to do. You know, once you saw that they had an ability, maybe you could figure out, oh, they picked this up in this part of the training data. But for example, some of the early things that we discovered with GPT-4, it could create visual images for you by writing computer code to render SVG graphics, essentially. Even though this is a model that was only trained on text, you know, it's a text in, text out model, but it was capable of producing text that had some coherence to the images it would create. Or GPT-3 was really bad at basic arithmetic. You know, it couldn't reliably multiply small numbers. And GPT-4 in those days, I'm still not really sure how it could do it, but you could give it two 15-digit numbers and have it multiply them by each other. And it wouldn't get this exactly right, right? If it really got the math correct, I could maybe understand that. Yeah. Instead, it would be off by just, you know, 100,000ths of a percentage point. It's multiplying these 15-digit numbers by each other, and it would be off by like 7 or something like that at the end. And it's just very, very strange.
There are all these weird quirks and deficiencies, like you can tell it to win at tic-tac-toe and it'll do as good a job as is humanly possible. But if you tell it to lose at tic-tac-toe, it has more trouble. There are things like that where it clearly doesn't understand those concepts in the sense that we do. But that said, did you become convinced early on, and do you believe now, that there is a sense in which it's representing concepts is somewhere in the neural net?
I think yes, but I find that often questions like this are really sensitive to what people mean by different things, like what it means to represent something. Mm-hmm. It's definitely true that there's a difference between an AI system being able to explain a concept to you versus being able to act on that consistently versus eventually whether it will choose to abide by that, right? And mm-hmm. so a model might be able to tell you what it means to lose a tic-tac-toe. It might be able to even tell you specific steps of how to lose a tic-tac-toe. But in a different context, when you're playing tic-tac-toe with it, it might not play those moves, even if you tell it to. And there are all sorts of different reasons that could be happening.
Yeah. And you said something interesting that, this was once you threw in post-training, it started getting really good at some stuff and seeming more like a human mind. And for people who don't know the terminology, there's a weird quirk, first of all, in the terminology, which is that there's pre-training and post-training, but no training. I'm not aware of anyone else who talks like that, but apparently that terminology has evolved. And when people talk about it, well, it's just a next, it's just autocorrect, it's just a next word predictor. That's pre-training, and that does a lot. But I think when it really got impressive was when you added post-training, which involves, we don't need to get into this, but involves kind of fine-tuning, reinforcement learning through human feedback and so on. So at that point, you have kind of a mature model. I have a question about the vibe in OpenAI at this time, because you get these reports like, so Ilya Sutskever, who was famously, this famous genius, he was involved in some early important developments in deep learning. And then I guess he was chief scientist maybe at OpenAI. He's no longer there. But he was famous for, the reports are that he popularized the mantra, feel the AGI. And I've never known, like, did he sign his emails that way? Did he walk down the hall mumbling it? Did they have pep rallies where people chanted it? Like, how did the term get popularized? And like, what exactly was going on?
Ilya definitely had a big role in it. I would be lying if I were confident that like no one else helped popularize it or might have even been first to it. I think an important thing to understand about Field the AGI is it definitely wasn't meant as a celebratory mantra. It was meant
more like that was my like next question. Good.
Yeah, more like understand the gravity of what we are building and how real it is going to get over time. I think Ilya did a really, really great job of this. An example of a type of thing that would happen, you know, we would have an all-hands meeting as a company, however many people were in the company at the time. And you would have a mix of different topics, right? Some are just kind of mundane, business as usual, could be happening at any technology company. And some of them are like, hey, by the way, you know, the AI is doing this crazy thing and it's going to keep getting better. And we aren't really sure what that means or how to control it. And I think it would be easy to lose sight of how jarringly different those are. And for people whose roles especially are maybe more on the here and now parts of the company, not thinking as far ahead to like what actually happens if OpenAI succeeds at this crazy thing that it is trying to do, or if someone else succeeds. And so Ilya's role was trying to play that tape forward and try to convey what it actually feels like to potentially be standing on an exponential curve. You know, exponentials are linear looking for a bit, and then very suddenly they aren't. And that's a domain that a lot of people don't have that much experience with. And so he's trying to help convey that.
Yeah, after COVID, more of them have it. But that was an example of exponential growth. It happened fast. And now, well, there's evidence, and I'm sure you're familiar with the studies showing that the length, if you measure AI coding ability in terms of the length it would take a human to do the task, a human programmer, it's like doubling every, I don't know, 4, 5, 6, 7 months. And it doesn't take long to, at that rate, for stuff to get weird. especially if it's happening in other realms and it isn't necessarily. But anyway, okay, so yeah, about that. So it wasn't, there was a sense of gravity and excitement at the same time, it sounds like.
I mean, definitely gravity. I think everyone at OpenAI kind of feels a different range of emotions depending on the day. And I'm someone who is very concerned about what ultimately happens from building these systems. And still, right, there would be times where I felt really excited about a new product that had been built, or, you know, I'm terrible at art. I can't draw anything. But when DALL-E 2 came out, it was maybe the first time that I felt like I could actually express my imagination visually. And that's like really, really cool and powerful. And also there were days where I felt as if we just had no handle on what it was going to take as systems continue to get more capable. Sometimes in terms of having intellectually grokked how hard this might be, and other times, you know, whether our practices were going to be adequate. And so there's both, do people understand why it might be hard, exactly how hard? And then there is, regardless of whether they understand, are the incentives of the company such that we expect to be on track, or, you know, ideally are already on track today? And those are different questions.
So you were, it sounds like you were, you kind of came into the company on the safety side as a kind of a safety person. And that's largely what you've been ever since. Now, some safety people, I gather, are, well, broadly speaking, some people who are out there opining about safety are not computer scientists at all. You do have a graduate degree in machine learning, so you're very technically conversant. I'm wondering, there's a kind of a stereotype about the AI safety crowd, or at least about people who are deeply concerned about the trajectory of this. And it is that it's very much informed by either, like a lot of these people came, it is said, came from either the rationalist community or the effective altruism community or both. There's some overlap. You know, of course, Eliezer Yudkowsky, perhaps the most famous doomer, ran the blog, and I guess still does, Less Wrong, which was kind of a big center of quote, rationalist discourse, where rationalist refers to a specific subculture, not just people who are rational. First of all, is there some truth to that? I mean, did it so happen that a lot of the people who were influential in the safety conversation early on, inside these big companies and outside them, did actually emerge from these, one or both of these cultures, EA or rationalism?
I guess jumping back, so I might be wrong about this. I don't think Eliezer runs Less Wrong. There's probably some relationship, but I believe that's run by a different team of people, like Oliver.
Could well be. I think he may have founded it or co-founded it, but in any event, sure.
Yes. Okay. I think it's interesting to trace the intellectual roots of this community. I'm sure that there are people who've come to it from one or gone to it. Like in my case, I'm trying to think about when I first became familiar with Eliezer. I think the first time was 2017 when I was working on this is like a lifetime ago, so forgive me on details. But I was working on a research project inside a consulting firm of what was happening at the frontier of AI and, you know, what this might mean for businesses. And so this might have been the first time I heard about OpenAI, certainly the first time that I got a detailed exposure. And at the same time, you know, I learned about the Machine Intelligence Research Institute, MIRI, which Eliezer has helped to run. But my interest in AI safety predates that as well. There's like a whole winding thing. I don't know. I feel like I'm not really answering the question very clearly. I think you are correct to observe that there are relationships between the different intellectual communities.
Because there are people who I guess, some people who are dismissive of some of the safety concerns would say, we have to remember, all these people came from this weird subculture, as it happens. You know, that's just an historical contingency. That is one thing that would be said. Let me ask you kind of a related question. Like, so one thing that's characteristic of, I think, that lineage of safety people is like cosmic doom scenarios, right? It's like, there's one kind of safety concern as well. People will use it to make bioweapons. Autonomous AI may get loose and kind of go rogue. We'll get it under control eventually, but it'll do a lot of damage. There's a lot of things, socially destabilizing things, maybe job displacement, a lot of kinds of concern. And then there's the AI takeover concern, right? Like, ultimately, if we're, you know, we may wind up either no longer existing or like subjugated, like in the movie The Matrix or something, and AI is just running the planet. And I think that cosmic version of doom, and I'm going to ask you in a second how seriously you take that, and I don't think it's crazy to take it seriously. I'm kind of agnostic, but that is particularly associated with that part of the rationalist community, right? There's a lot of that vibe in the rationalist community.
I think there's so many different threads here. Let me try to pull them apart.
Okay.
I think, like you said, you're correct in noticing that there is some path from people who are, you know, interested in working on important meaty problems and trying to do good with their career, right? Broadly, the AI sphere, mm-hmm. and coming to the belief that AI is really important and so is a field worth working on. I do also think there is this reverse flow where Les Wrong, the site that you've mentioned, is just like a really rich intellectual discussion hub for many of these topics where people mm-hmm. who care about them have found each other. That's actually more the causality in my case. Like, I've been working on AI safety for long before I was a Les Wrong reader, which honestly has taken off even more in the past, I would say, year or two, like in the process of post OpenAI life. In terms of what you are describing with bioweapons and takeover, I struggle to put exact terms on these. The thing that I often think about is the way that AI might contribute to catastrophic risks. And there are lots of different flavors of these. There is what might bad actors use an AI system to do. Mm-hmm. There is also what if AI systems have a volition for one reason or another to do something bad, which again could be a bad actor prompting them, telling them to do a bad thing. It also might be that the AI system has developed something like drives or goals that for one reason or another aren't the same as the goals that humans have. And so, you know, people will describe different levels of what it means for something to be catastrophic. Certainly there are people who argue that AI can or will, you know, lead to an extinction event for humans. Mm-hmm. There are people who will argue that it will be, you know, a tremendous mass casualty event, but maybe not go so far as extinction. You'll hear people argue that humans will lose control over the future per se. Maybe this happens without any casualties, you know? AI just comes to run the show and humans are along for the ride and they couldn't make different decisions if they wanted to. All of those seem like quite bad to me if they happen. And I don't think that they depend on believing in full extinction scenarios. Mm-hmm. I find it difficult to rule out those scenarios, right? But I don't think that AI safety folks need to win. You know, yes, it might mean literally every person on Earth falls prey to an adversarial AI system or something like that. I think that would be like a tremendously high bar to have concern. And that with all sorts of other risks, you know, people are rightfully concerned at much, much lower bars.
Yeah. And one thing pretty much all the risks have in common, I guess, is that you could argue that they are exacerbated by the racing dynamic that you have lamented, the dynamic among the companies. And, you know, I think it's kind of undeniable that there's a race on. My sense is that some people would justify that by saying, well, we're the good guys, and if we get there first, we'll do it right. We'll make sure and like solve alignment or something. We'll get into that. You know, if we get there first, things will be okay. Is that, do you think that's one thing that's maybe not driving the racing dynamic, but helping to justify it in the minds of some of the racers?
I think that's part of it. I would separate out a belief that, you know, if I get there first, I will use it responsibly from I believe that I know how to get there without incurring big risks mm-hmm. along the way. Those are different. This is good timing. I've actually been working on a piece in the background about, you know, US-China competition on AI and what are the different things driving the conflict or the competition. So certainly there is some amount of, if we get there first, we will use it for good. I also think there is just reasonable fear of what an adversary with a powerful AI system might do. You know, these technologies are going to be militarily significant. I think it is understandable why states would fear that competitors develop very powerful AI systems, that they don't have them. To be clear, I don't think that means it's a good equilibrium for the world. I think these are coordination failures. I call this in the piece regretful racing. The idea that, you know, you and I might each prefer that we just neither build AGI. We don't want to take the risk. But if you're going to build it, I feel like I have to build it too, and vice versa. And the consequence of that is we end up in an equilibrium where here we both are building it, even if we think it's risky, even if we're terrified of the other one having it, because we don't think that we have a way to coordinate on not building it. And so to me, one of the most important problems today is figuring out how can we get something like verifiable mechanisms to tell that other states aren't pursuing AGI. And that can be the basis of cooperation, be it on, you know, maybe we're both going to build AGI, but we're going to do it with certain safety standards in place that we're each going to follow. Or, you know, maybe we can even agree to slow down or not develop these systems at all.
Yeah, the US-China thing has kind of trickle-down effects. I mean, it helps drive, I think, intensify the race within the US in the sense that if anybody talks about like regulating these companies, they say, no, oh, you can't do that because we're in this existential race with China. In fact, we would like some government subsidies for energy and stuff. And one could argue that in some cases that is cynical, like lobbying talking points. I actually did an experiment. I wrote about this in the Non-Zero newsletter. You know, the three companies, so Google, Anthropic, and OpenAI, responded to this government request for input on AI policy a few months ago. And I hypothesized that if you ranked the companies in terms of how much their reports emphasize the importance of winning the race with China, that would correspond to the ranking with how much they demanded subsidies and or no light regulation. So I actually asked ChatGPT to rank them along both things and another LLM, and everyone agreed that OpenAI was at the top of both models agreed that OpenAI was at the top of both. Now, so I really think that's like the linchpin of racing, right? It's like so long as the US is in a race with China, it's going to be hard to get any of these companies to slow down. In fact, you know, you showed up at OpenAI at about the time that Dario Amade, or probably not the way he pronounces it, left to form Anthropic out of safety concerns, out of concern that OpenAI wasn't doing enough. But he is one of the most ardent China racers. I think in his case, not so much for cynical lobbying reasons as maybe ideological ones, but in any event, and he has this idea that, well, if we get far enough ahead of China, then really, within, we'll slow down. I'm skeptical of that. But okay, so all of this is prelude to a question I have for you. Well, first, a little question. You were on Nathan Labenza's podcast, Cognitive Revolution. I thought I inferred from something you said that you support the chip restrictions on the export of advanced AI chips and equipment to China. Is that right?
Broadly, yeah. Like, I think the extent of that support probably depends on the specifics, but yes.
Yeah. And I think that's actually, am I wrong in thinking that's actually pretty common in the safety community, right?
I think so. I mean, yeah. I think part of what you're noticing is that even within this race framing, which I actually think is not a super helpful framing for the competition, can talk more about that. But, you know, it's important to notice that there are two different ways to win a race. You can accelerate yourself or you can decelerate your adversary. I think that decelerating has a lot of merit to it. To me, it's just like a very, very natural thing to believe. I think there are maybe like second order reasons to be hesitant about it. Like, I think there is a fair question about if the US tries to decelerate China, to what extent does that increase the chance that China feels backed into a corner and takes more aggressive action on Taiwan or something like that?
Well, yeah. I mean, just to drill down on that, I apologize to listeners who have heard me point this out a billion times. But now that we have made it so that the advanced chips coming out of the factories on Taiwan are coming to the West, but not to China, that would, if anything, make China less reluctant to invade if other, you know, because the factories would probably get blown up or otherwise disabled in the course of a war. So, yeah, it very much increases the chances, I think, of invasion. But go ahead.
I don't know. I mean, I think both trying to decelerate China and accelerate our own efforts increase the chances of tension over Taiwan. Like, it actually isn't clear to me which one has a stronger connection. I think it's kind of like an uncertain empirical claim. But certainly, I think that we should be considering both approaches. I think it's very unlikely that the U.S. could get some win in this competition just by accelerating itself. And in fact, I think that people might not have thought thoroughly enough about what this actual end game looks like, or at least there's some maybe subtle implications of it that I wish were better understood. In particular, people use this term race, right? In a race, you're competing to be the first across the finish line. And if you're the first one to get there, you win. That's very different than my mental model of how powerful AI works. I think even if the US gets to a very powerful AI system before China, there are lots of ways that this still goes very badly for the world. Mm-hmm. And so the frame that I like to think about isn't about racing and trying to be the first to a powerful level of AI. It's about containment and how the US stops China. And, you know, notice that China probably feels the same about the US from developing very powerful AI systems that pose a risk to them. And this frame is kind of, can you mutually contain each other and verify that the other is not building AGI? Because otherwise, just racing and trying to be there first, I don't think goes well in the end.
And why do you think we have to contain them and hinder their AI progress? What are you afraid they'll do with their AI?
I don't know that I have a super specific fear per se. But the arguments that get made for racing are things like, you know, AI might be the most important military technology of the past century. It could confer very, very strong military advantages. And I think if you believe that's true, the right outcome is not to race. It is you're afraid of China developing these very strong military AI technologies. China is also afraid of the US developing these powerful military AI technologies. Is there a way that you can make it that neither of you ultimately develop these?
Right. And I mean, first of all, to be clear on the acceleration, decelerate, you know, should we accelerate or just make China decelerate? One point I was trying to make is the former is entailed in the latter, or it's inherent. It seems to be inherently linked to it because the deceleration effort is part of a whole set of talking points, another of whose byproducts is we can't let our companies slow down. We can't regulate them. We can't do this. So what we're getting is both. And I think as a practical matter, that's what you get. Again, Dario Modi says someday we'll be so comfortably ahead that, I don't know, something will happen to Sam Altman's ego or something. I don't know what he has in mind, but I'm skeptical of that. But anyway, for the time being, both are happening. The larger question I have, my own view is that if you take these risks pretty seriously, as I do, most of the risks, including some very grave ones, I'm pretty sure will transpire, at least as risks. We may prevent them from being realized, but as real risks. And then out and out AI takeover, I don't dismiss. I can't find a killer argument against it. Could, but in any event, if you just look at the ones that I'm pretty sure will happen, and I suspect you would agree, it seems to me, in the long run, it's impossible to imagine really doing a good job of containing them without extensive international cooperation. I wanted to pause and ask if you agree. Do you agree with me on that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like, this is kind of what I'm gesturing toward with the idea that the U.S. wants to contain China. China wants to contain the U.S. Part mm-hmm. of the issue is there aren't any known methods today to verify that each other aren't pursuing AGI. But mm-hmm. it is hard for me to see a way out of this that does not run through verifiable non-development. An important catch here is that the U.S. and China don't trust each other on these questions, right? And in fact, they actively mistrust. And so whatever treaty you come up with needs to be strong enough to actually overcome that mistrust on a technology that both states consider to be critical. I think sometimes people are just like way too pessimistic about the ability to come up with such a treaty. You know, this is not entirely novel. There are things like the Chemical Weapons Convention. Mm-hmm. Both the US and China are party to this. In fact, almost the entire world is party to this. And, you know, these treaties are not perfect, right? It might be the case that things get through from time to time. It might also be the case on AI that we have some treaty and there's some cheating around the margins. And that's unfortunate. It's to be expected. It still might be really impactful if you mm-hmm. can rule out a wide range of otherwise risky behavior and force some of this to the margins. You know, people cannot brazenly build powerful military AI systems. They need to do it, under cloak in various ways, and therefore are more limited in the types of actions they can take to pursue this. I think there are real benefits there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I agree. First of all, there have been really impressive achievements on the international governance front. And there has been backsliding, especially lately, but it's doable. I would also say AI is a bigger challenge as a technical matter than chemical weapons or nuclear weapons, as you would probably agree, I assume, in terms of the level of transparency, the number, you know, it's a more kind of elusive technology, and it's less, well, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong. I hope I'm wrong. Do you think it's no more challenging than, say, a well-enforced nuclear agreement, or?
I don't think I have a very informed view here, other than, you know, some of these treaties already exist and others don't. And so that's mm-hmm. kind of evidence on their face that they have been doable. Also, states have been motivated to do it. And I don't know that that's the case at the moment with AI.
Well, I think that's true. And the thing I find frustrating about the conversation, and the issue that I really wish a lot of people in the safety community would address, who favor chip controls, and almost don't even see a need to articulate the reason, although they have, I don't doubt that they have one. I just mean it seems so widely accepted that this policy position isn't much examined. And what I would say is, if you believe that you're going to need extensive international cooperation, as I do, of a kind of a fine-grained kind, and I personally think of an unprecedented kind, and I've written in the past about these other, you know, nuclear non-proliferation treaty. I was, you know, advocating in various journalistic venues, the Chemical Weapons Convention, these many years ago. I think this is going to be harder. It's more challenging. It demands not just formal agreement. I would say something that you could call the kind of organic transparency you get when you are just engaged with a country economically. You know, you're just having discourse along a lot of channels. Your scientists are talking to each other. I think you need some of that. So anyway, if you accept the premise that you're really, you know, before we get to AGI, we're going to have the international cooperation problem solved. I would say, first of all, to judge by the estimates of a lot of people, some of them credible, we better hurry, right? And B, that's going to mean just turning around our relationship with China. And we better start now. And if you don't understand that from their point of view, those chip controls are tantamount to a declaration of war, I don't think you're doing a good enough job of putting yourself in the shoes of people in other countries, okay? We are, on the one hand, saying, hey, this is the whole future. This is the secret of dominance, of international dominance. And we're going to have it, and you're not. And yeah, the factories are, they're on this island that you consider part of, you know, your country, and you could take it over, sure, but no, we're not going to let you have it. I would at least like to hear people explain what magical thing is going to happen to turn around the relationship if we don't start making a concerted effort and just prioritize détente with China. I don't quite understand why virtually nobody in the AI safety community is saying what I just said.
Yeah, I guess let me take a crack at the object level question and then some of the meta around it. Like, I think what you were saying about chip controls being seen as hostile, mm-hmm. like, probably true. I think it also is read as hostile if the US is accelerating itself for similar rationale, right? Like, regardless whether we are trying to race faster because we are afraid of China and want to get to AGI first, or decelerate them because we are afraid of China and want to get to AGI first, I think that these are both correctly and reasonably understood as being, you know, aggressive and signaling untrustworthiness. I think that it's different from the question of whether they are justified, right? But I don't think it's correct that chip controls would be like an act of aggression and that other things going on aren't. I suppose there's some endgame.
Can I just interject, you know, and take exception mm-hmm. with that? I mean, one reason the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor is because we were trying to cut off their supply of oil. There was an oil embargo. If we hadn't been doing that, they wouldn't have been complaining that we were using oil. I just think there's a very different psychological impact, between denying people something they think is rightfully theirs and just, you know, proceeding on your own path and doing what you're allowing them to do. So I don't agree. But anyway, go ahead.
In your worldview, is this like uniquely a bad denial because the chips are coming from Taiwan, or if these factories were, you know, always coming out of Texas and the U.S. was deciding not to sell them to China, do you take that as being a similar act of aggression?
Well, I think the Taiwan thing makes this a kind of distinctively precarious thing to do first. But I would never say we don't have the right to do it or anything like that, the legal right to do it. But what I would say is that even if they were coming from Texas, I would say, I think it is still going to be viewed as a kind of an act of aggression. And if you agree with me, we need to turn the relationship around pronto. You need to think about doing something other than continuing to intensify it, right? And at a minimum, I mean, here's what frustrates me the most, I guess, is like Dario Amodei says, by the way, you would know how to pronounce his name. Not that I'm going to remember this, but how do you pronounce his last name?
Amodei.
Is that good? He says, so we should, you know, do the chip controls, accelerate our own thing, and get to a point of what he calls, you know, clear military dominance, And then we should, you know, we and our Western allies should preserve the dominance through technological controls, whatever, until China, I think he says, like, abandons their anti-democratic ways. I can't tell if he means regime change or what. But in any event, what I don't get is, why aren't they saying the goal of using this lever is not to transform China's system of government? We don't have time for that. And besides, recent history shows it rarely works. But to push them into the kind of cooperative arrangement you would favor, right? Like, is anyone saying that? Is anyone saying, well, the end game should be that we tell China that we will take the chip controls off incrementally as they agree to these rules of the road regarding AI, and then we slowly get enmeshed in these cooperative arrangements? Yeah. Is anybody saying that?
You know, you've said a lot of things, and so I don't want to, like, claim I endorse all of them. No, you're fine.
I don't. I'm taking frustration that other people gave me out on you. I'm sorry.
You're totally fine. I think this is, like, my worldview is that the right end game of the U.S.-China competition is to recognize that it isn't a race. It is about, you know, what I'm calling contain and verify, to recognize that both the U.S. and China have an interest in the other not developing this powerful technology. And we need to get to a way to verify that the other is not building it. And in fact, like, we could play forward the tape in all sorts of different ways. I think that there is no good ending that doesn't rely on something like this. So, for example, in Dario's example, which I quote in this piece, you know, maybe it'll come out later today, maybe it'll come out tomorrow, we'll see. You're telling it correctly that the U.S. And Western allies get a large lead, and they use this to extract a concession from China. China agrees to stop pursuing this and not have to have conflict with the U.S. in return for economic benefits. And I think the right question is, you know, how does this happen? Like, how large a lead does the U.S. need to have over a very powerful other state to extract this? And more importantly, why is the U.S. going to feel confident that China has, in fact, changed its posture and is no longer trying to pursue AGI? And I think you run into a kind of tricky double bind, is what I would call it, right? Like, all the branches here are difficult. If there is a way that the U.S. can verify that China has stopped, I mean, that's great news. That's what's going to be needed to end the competition. But why don't we pursue such a thing today and try to use it to de-escalate and avoid this conflict? Or maybe it's just not going to be possible to verify that China has stopped building AGI, even at the point that we've gotten there first. Mm-hmm. And that's, like, a really, really difficult situation. You know, some people might think this means the US has won the race because the US built AGI, it got there before China. If the US can't actually verify that China is stopping its competing AGI development efforts, the competition is not over. You know, leads change on AI. You can get leapfrogged. The U.S. is worried about getting leapfrogged today. You know, China might race more desperately to build AGI and incur all sorts of risks that we've been talking about. You know, a world where the U.S. has gotten to AGI first, but has not verified that China has stopped building AGI is not stable. And part of my hope is that we'll look ahead and see, wow, that is going to be really, really hard, especially maybe even at the point that the U.S. has AGI and China now views this as conceding and losing, right? A defeat. And it would be better if we could figure out ahead of time ways to come to an agreement to just neither build this. And I'm not naive, right? I understand that this is going to be, like, extremely difficult. And there are all sorts of reasons for the U.S. and China to mistrust each other. And also, you know, reality is what it is. Like, I think this just might be the way that we have to go to get to a good outcome.
You mean what we're doing now?
Oh, no, like, very much not what we are doing
Okay,
now. The idea of figuring out a verifiable treaty to not develop powerful, risky AI systems. I don't know exactly where to draw the line, but I think people know broadly the class of thing that I'm referring to.
And when you talk about getting AI to China to stop, just to be clear, you're talking about symmetrical stoppage. We both agree to at either actually stop because we think that such trouble lies beyond a certain threshold of technological development, or at least agree to a bunch of other symmetrical stuff, proceed slowly with certain controls and so on. But anyway, your goal is something symmetrical.
Yes, with caveats. Like, I think it's important for people to recognize that asymmetric stuff is going to be really, really hard and rely on many of the same mechanisms that symmetric stuff does. And so if you think that you can get asymmetric concessions from China, you actually might have the verification methods needed to do something symmetric. And I hope that both countries would see it's in their interest to de-escalate in various ways, which, as you're pointing out, that can mean a bunch of things, right? It could mean not building these. It can mean building these more slowly. It can mean building these in tandem, you know, something like the International Space Station for AI, an international mega project. There are a bunch of ways that are better than the U.S. and China unilaterally racing, from my perspective.
Yeah. And I don't think you're going to get a significant asymmetric concessions in the sense of them just settling for a subordinate position. So I agree. Symmetrical would be
great. What do you think happens? Right. Because in my understanding, this is Dario's envisioned endgame. And I think that of the AI leaders, he has one of the clearest end games spelt out, which is basically the U.S. gets there first. It has a dominant enough lead that it uses global pressure to extract these concessions asymmetrically. I am fairly skeptical of this, but I'm curious what you think happens at that point if China won't concede.
Oh, I think there's so many problems with that scenario. First of all, you are leading to, it is creating a racing dynamic both with the U.S. and with China. And just more bad stuff can happen, even if inadvertently, as was pointed out in this recent paper by several people, Dan Hendricks, Eric Schmidt, and Alexander Wang. Once you get close to AGI or superintelligence, if it really, you know, if one side seems to be clearly ahead, the other side has a strong incentive to play rough. You know, actual bombing data centers or serious cyber. So it's destabilizing in that way. And then I just think to imagine that we like masterfully calibrate this ascent to dominance and then like turn on a dime and do exactly the right diplomatic stuff to get China to peacefully concede is just naive in the extreme. I mean, first of all, to whip up American China phobia in a way that supports the policy, which is being done now, you know, that's a ship that's hard to turn around, first of all, and we're a democracy. So to suddenly say, oh, no, we were kidding. They're not a mortal threat. They're not an existential threat. Suddenly, I mean, it's just the American foreign policy apparatus has not shown tremendous deftness, I would say, to say the least, over in recent decades. I think it used to show more, actually. And I just think you're talking about threading a geopolitical needle. And to do that, you have to thread a domestic political needle. And I don't doubt that Dario is super smart in his realm of expertise, but I just think it's mind-blowingly naive, is my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, to be clear, like, I agree this is also really, really difficult, and this is part of why I want to head off the dynamic. I think I should say, you know, what is the limit of the abilities on AGI, right? Like, for people who believe that AGI is powerful enough to have take over the world scenarios, you know, what's harder, taking over the world or convincing China to asymmetrically yield on this, right? Like, I get it. You have a very, very powerful AI system. I am open to the idea that it now allows you to work diplomatic miracles that we couldn't have otherwise anticipated or planned out. Like, sure. And also, boy, is it going to be bad if we are wrong about this. Or, you know, we believe we have an AI system capable enough to chart a path to that. Mm-hmm. And in fact, we don't. Or China gets one right on the heels of us. Or there are just like so many ways that this could go so poorly.
And I can imagine a good reply to what I just said, which is that, well, you're gonna you know, turn around this relationship and orchestrate this unprecedented level of international cooperation? Isn't that kind of threading a needle? Yeah, that's going to be a big challenge. I just think there's no happy ending without that degree of international cooperation, and I think you're as unlikely maybe it as it is to attain at all. You're more likely to attain it with you know, at an acceptable cost if it's done peacefully, and you just start talking to nations about the fact that in a certain sense we face a common threat, and maybe that will become clearer in the next year or so, that really this technology is enough of a challenge to humankind that we need to address it together.
Yeah, you know, I'm trying to do my part by like putting out hopefully good, clear thinking on this. I was reading earlier today that J.D. Vance has engaged with the AI 2027 scenario. You know, he was asked about whether the U.S. would pause if China were to pause. I think there is some intellectual progress on these questions and hopefully helping people play forward the tape a bit more.
I saw a reference to that. I haven't looked it up, but it sounds like it would have to be progress compared to what he said in Paris, which was, you know, if you remember, it was like we should do we should be the opposite of risk averse, which I think literally, no, he said we should be the opposite of too risk averse, which I think is literally not risk averse enough. And so, okay, sounds like he's improving. Okay, well, as you know, we on this podcast, most of it is available to the public. Then we go into what's called overtime, which is available to paid subscribers of the Non-Zero newsletter. And I promise to change the subject. We won't be talking about China. I want to get you to talk about various things. Well, I do want to including the OpenAI nonprofit issue. The recent issue with sycophantic OpenAI LLM, which I know you've written about on your newsletter, which again is called Steven Adler's Substack. Maybe talk a little about agentic AI if we have any time. And people can become paid subscribers at nonzero.org or by clicking the link in the show notes and have access to overtime. Before we go into overtime, Steven, is there anything else you want to say by way of summing up?
No, I think you covered it. Yeah. Let's go overtime.
Okay. It's a safer place. There are fewer people listening. We'll enjoy it. Okay. Thanks everybody who followed us this far. We are headed into overtime.